The fruitcake has become something of a holiday joke. Fortunately, just in time for this holiday season, Gail Monahan has made the fruitcake glamorous again. In her new book, Lost Desserts, Delicious Indulgences of the Past, Recipes from Legendary and Famous Chefs. It features recipes and pictures of bygone desserts and the stories behind the people who came up with them, published by Rizzoli. And I'm very pleased to welcome Gail Monahan to the show today. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for having me here. I'm happy to be here.
Now, what qualifies these recipes in this book as lost?
Well, it's a little bit personal, but basically, the book came out of an article I did for House and Garden, where the desserts were clearly five lost recipes from closed restaurants from my Los Angeles childhood. So it was very clear. But then when it became a book, I continued with that theme about closed restaurants, but there were only so many closed restaurants that had fabulous desserts. So mostly that is what the desserts are, restaurants from chefs, dead chefs or closed restaurants. However, I also included classics that seemed to me shouldn't be relegated to oblivion, that should be brought back, things like that, and occasionally a recipe of a person from their family.
So all of these recipes were invented at a certain point, and then as long as the inventor was making them, they were around? Or is this more a matter of a dessert reflecting a kind of a fashion of a time, and then things change?
I think it's both. I think the ones that come from restaurants basically were often signature desserts from a restaurant and did stop being made or stop being made in any great quantity when the restaurant closed. But then there are others like a Bavarian or a Charlotte or a Charlotte Russe that were more traditional desserts, and it was just a type of dessert that seemed to go out of fashion.
Now, Charlotte Russe was something that I ate when I was a kid. Growing up in Williamsburg, it was basically a piece of sponge cake with a lot of whipped cream and then a maraschino cherry on the top, and it was held together by a piece of cardboard. That was the cardboard wrapping. You're not talking about that.
I'm not, although that's the Charlotte Russe that my father, growing up in New York, also remembers. But apparently that was sold at local bakeries and often called a Charlie Russe or a Charlie Rouge or something, but was a variation of a real Charlotte Russe, which was a mold lined with ladyfingers and basically filled with a flavored gelatin-based custard, flavored essentially with a Bavarian that could be a fruit flavor or coffee or chocolate.
And it sounds a lot more inviting, in fact.
Although apparently people love those Charlie Russes.
Well, yeah, when I was 8 or 9, I thought that was fabulous.
Right.
In a couple of cases, these recipes died when their creators just decided not to make them anymore, as in the case of Patrick, is it Lemble?
Lemble, I think.
Lemble, he made these coffee cup souffles at the Four Seasons and then just decided at some point not to make them anymore, despite the fact that they were incredibly popular.
Well, I think he was not the first pastry chef at the Four Seasons. He was probably the third or the fourth, and I think he inherited this recipe, and it had been on the menu from the time the restaurant opened, and it is quite delicious, but I just think he thought enough was enough. I think it had never come off the menu. It wasn't even seasonal. He just felt, a new broom sweeping clean, enough of this.
And a lot of chefs have told me, I should have spoken to Michael LaMonaco about that, that at a certain point they get bored with making something, and then when they take it off the menu, their customers come in and say, I come here for that. How could you do that to me? And they in some cases they feel trapped. In other cases, they just simply say, I got to move on.
Yeah, I've heard that over and over again. I know in the book I have a chocolate bread pudding with brandy custard sauce from Arcadia, which apparently was never off the menu, that she couldn't take it off the menu. People complained.
Now, you started researching this. First, it was just personal stuff from Los Angeles.
First, it was an article for House and Garden that was personal stuff. Desserts I remembered from my childhood. I remembered them. The restaurants had closed. I researched it. I found the desserts.
Haven't many of them survived in modified forms?
Oh, I think so. They're not. We're not talking about something from Greek or Roman times that I had to dig under the earth to find. But I think they are out of favor. Yes, most of them. These are desserts that people did love. They've been around there in cookbooks.
And then you had to find the old cookbook and recreate them.
The old cookbook or an old article or talk to somebody who'd worked at a restaurant.
I'm sure you had to update them to some degree. Or could you make them exactly the way they were made 100 years ago?
Mostly not. They tended for my palate to be often too bland or too rich or too sweet or have too much candied fruit. Some of them you could stick closer to the real recipe. But most things I jiggered around one way or another for a contemporary palate. I also tried to simplify them when that was doable, although a lot of them were, you know, they're not that complicated, most of them, to begin with.
Talking about candied fruit, you have two fruitcake recipes here. Is the fact that there was too much candied fruit the reason that fruitcake became so maligned?
I think so, although neither of those are like that kind of brown fruitcake you get in a can at Christmas that you sort of re-gift immediately. One of these, the James Beard Venetian fruitcake, is hardly a fruitcake. It's an Italian polenta cake with a little bit of, you know, currants and raisins and a little bit of, it's got a little brandy in it. It just is divine. I mean, it's a simple, not very rich cake that was an epiphany cake apparently in Venice. And it, I mean, James Beard called it a fruitcake, but it really isn't. You know, it's got a sort of a little bit of fruit the way a panettone would. The Four Seasons fruitcake in the book is more of a fruitcake, but even then I've limited the fruits to the ones that are less revolting. I mean, they're bright green and bright red. We don't have that.
Now, a lot of these stories, these desserts have interesting stories behind them. Escoffier's Peach Melba, for example. Now, we've all heard of Peach Melba. Can you get an Escoffier Peach Melba these days anywhere?
Probably, or maybe not. I mean, nowhere that I know.
You have to make it from the book.
You have to make it from the book or from Escoffier's book. I mean, he invented it in 1894 for Dame Nellie Melba, who was an Australian opera diva. And then maybe 30 years later, complained voraciously that nobody stuck to his recipe and people were adulterating it, and he went on and on. But, yeah, it's a great story. I mean, he invented it for her when she was having a tiff with her lover, the Count de Paris, who was the pretender to the—his father was the pretender to the throne of France. And he was she was married, and he wasn't allowed to marry a commoner, but they had this torrid affair. And when they were having a sort of a tiff, when they were having a problem, she asked Escoffier to do an intimate dinner for the two of them and a couple of friends at the Savoy, where she was staying while singing in Covent Garden, and he was cooking. And Escoffier sculpted a huge swan out of ice and nestled a silver bowl in it with the peaches and the raspberry puree, and it did patch up their relationship for the time being. But in the end, it ended, and she went into the doldrums and got fat, and he invented he invented Melba toast so that she could go on a diet at that point.
Well, she's one of those people who was honored with two dishes, but a lot of dishes have been designed to honor people, often desserts for some reason.
Yeah, often desserts. I mean, the pavlova was an Australian meringue and fruit dessert that honored the ballerina pavlova. I guess it was something they made when she went to Australia and danced.
Although I wonder whether she would have wanted to eat something like that. After all, she had to stay very thin.
Well, I think the original one, though, may have just been fruit and meringue. So that's sort of fat-free. I mean, the one I do, although I don't have it in the book, the one I do has also ice cream and whipped cream. She wouldn't have wanted to eat that.
In those days, the great chefs cooked everything from the beginning of the meal to the end of the meal. Now desserts are a whole separate, in some cases, a whole separate kitchen within a restaurant. And then there are the people who do the baking and the people who do the other desserts. It's become much more specialized.
It has, although Carême started out as a pastry chef. And then when he was working for Talleyrand, he had a mentor there who was a famous chef, you know, a full-blown chef who did everything. And then he became a chef and did everything. But Carême started out, and so they divided it up a little bit then too.
How much does nostalgia play in the fond memories of these things? For example, you talked about growing up in Los Angeles and eating desserts at Chasen's, for example. Do you think that the desserts were really great, or were they great because you remember having had a wonderful time when you were a kid? I mean, I remember Tuff and Eddie's green apple pie a la mode in New York. I have no idea whether that was any good, but at the time, it just, when I was 10 or 11 and my parents took me there, that just seemed like the height of sophistication.
Yeah, I don't know. I think part of it is nostalgia, because in reality, I do feel that the desserts in this book are basically delicious. However, I have refixed many of them. So whether they were absolutely delicious to the palate of the time, you know, at the time the dessert was created, I mean, certainly in America, we have the food in restaurants, as far as I'm concerned, is so much better now than it was 30 and 40 and 50 years ago. You know, maybe this was delicious at the time because it was the best you could get. I mean, certainly, though, something like a Schraff's butterscotch sundae, which I didn't have to change at all, just is delicious, or their coffee milkshake, or a C.C. Brown's hot fudge sundae. I mean, some of that stuff just is delicious without changing it, or the Blum's coffee crunch cake, which I changed a little bit, but I didn't really have to. It was fabulous. You know, I think a lot of it really was fabulous, and then some of it needed doctoring. I tried to pick things that were really good. There were maybe 500 other recipes I tested that I didn't use.
My guest is Gail Monahan, whose book, Lost Desserts, Delicious Indulgences of the Past, Recipes from Legendary and Famous Chefs, is published by Rizzoli. First, we wind up with these French chefs, and then a lot of American desserts. There are some traditions that don't produce as many great desserts. For example, as wonderful as Italian cuisine is, beyond gelato and some people love tiramisu and a few other dishes, it's not really a big dessert cuisine.
No, I've always felt that. Italian desserts have never been my favorites, although I adore gelato. I mean, so that possibly makes up for everything. You know, I mean, the Italians, as far as I'm concerned, didn't have to do anything. Spaghetti and gelato is, yeah, you know, more than enough. But it is true. I mean, I have a cassata siciliana in the book, which is kind of a combination of cake layered with fresh ricotta and chocolate and maraschino and dried fruits and ice with buttercream and all these fruits on the top. And it's quite fabulous if you like that sort of thing. It is not really my favorite kind of dessert.
Most of the cooking shows on television devote little time to the dessert course. Why do you think that is?
Maybe. I don't know why, really. I'm not a huge television watcher, but maybe because something like a cake takes all that time to bake? I don't know why. I mean, I don't know why. If that's actually true, I don't know why.
Well, I would assume it's because we think that the appetizer, the main course, are the big thing. Maybe desserts should even be skipped. And in Europe, often they are. A cheese course replaces desserts because people are concerned about all the calories.
Well, I don't know if it's because people are concerned
about
all the calories.
You don't have to worry about it.
But I mean, cheese has a lot of calories. I think it maybe is just a different palate, because certainly a cheese course has as many calories as a basic dessert. Do you know what I'm saying? Salad and cheese is one thing, but cheese is, I don't know. I mean, I think often Europeans you think about them as having maybe a little bit less of a sweet tooth, or I feel like they're satisfied with a little tiny piece of dessert, whereas Americans, you have these huge portions. I don't know. I mean, I think dessert is a great thing to make, because I really feel that you can mess up the dinner, and if the dessert is fabulous and glamorous and kind of spellbinding, you know, people go away thinking they've had a great experience. So I think dessert, making of desserts, there's something to be said for it.
There are people, a close friend just says she cuts all sugar in half when she's baking something. And I've told her that sometimes throws off the chemistry of the dessert. Perhaps she should just pick things that don't have much sugar in them in the first place.
Have you tasted them? How do they taste?
They taste okay, but I'm not sure whether they measure up to what the person who wrote the cookbook had in mind.
I mean,
you're making faces here.
Well,
does that bother
I don't know.
As
well,
a
I mean,
baker,
I guess,
does that bother you?
I guess so. I mean, certainly when some of these older desserts that went back to the 1700s, I did end up cutting sugar, but it really was because it was so sweet, it tasted bad. I guess I'm big on authenticity, so I guess I feel like, as you kind of said, that if you really want less sugar, there are plenty of desserts that have less sugar in them, that I might make that, or I might make the one with the sugar, I need a smaller piece of it. I mean, something like cheesecake doesn't have that much sugar. It's got a lot of fat, but it's not really very sweet.
The book has gorgeous photographs. How important is presentation to the overall experience of eating a dessert?
I think it is important.
In restaurants, often people say, ooh, when the desserts come out.
I think
they don't say that when a meat dish comes out.
No, but I think it's important. I think it's important. I mean, in this book, I've tried to focus on trolley cart, you know, old-fashioned, more trolley cart desserts than individual plated, you know, desserts that are plated and beautiful in the presentation in that way. But I do think the cake should be attractive. I don't think it has to be spectacular looking, but I think if you're going to make, for instance, I have a chocolate bread pudding in here, and you want to doctor it up, you want to put a little powdered sugar on it, you want to do something, because basically brown bread, although this dessert is amazingly delicious, it doesn't, you know, you have to work on it to make it look good. I think it's nice. I don't think it's necessary, but I think it is nice if you can try to make it look nice.
Gail Monahan is a food writer and editor. Her articles have appeared in Oprah, Food and Wine, House and Garden. She's edited Jeremiah Tower Cooks and other books. And she is the author of Perfect Picnics for All Seasons, and now a gorgeous book from Rizzoli that is about desserts that are legendary in many cases, with photographs, gorgeous photographs by Eric Roman. It's called Lost Desserts, Delicious Indulgences of the Past, Recipes from Legendary Restaurants and Famous Chefs. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me. This was fun.